This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Imagine you are a scientist exploring the secrets of the atom. Then society takes that discovery to make bombs that blow up cities. Now imagine you study the way water breaks up rock underground. It's an obscure specialty until industry leaders decide to use that data to explode the underground for methane, also known as natural gas. Money is made, but that technological choice blows up the future. They call it fracking. Since 1977, Dr. Anthony R. Engraffia has been a popular professor teaching structural mechanics and fracture mechanics at Cornell University in New York State. He and his students published over 200 scientific papers. Engraffia has been a lead investigator in projects for major corporations like Boeing and Grumman and for government agencies like NASA and the National Science Foundation. He's won a ton of awards for his work. When it comes to fracking rock, this is an expert's expert. From Ithaca, New York, Anthony Engraffia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for the honor of being with you today, Alex.
Is it all right if I call you Tony?
Please do.
Okay. Now, in 2011, you and another professor at Cornell, Robert Howarth, published two major papers on the climate impacts of fracking. And in November 2011, I interviewed Dr. Howarth and broadcast the Radio EcoShock show titled Fracking Gas Equals Climate Crash. Now it's 7 years later. We knew what was coming. Has the gamble of frack gas turned out as you thought it would?
Unfortunately, it did. And I don't mean that in a positive sense. I mean that in a negative sense. What my colleague Bob Howarth and I predicted in our 2011 papers has unfortunately been borne out by subsequent science done by many people in government, in academia, not only in the U.S., but around the world.
Well, let's go back a bit. Tony, what were you studying about underground rock before frack gas became a mainstay of energy production in North America?
I had begun studying fracture of rock in my doctoral studies in the mid-1970s initially to try to understand how to mine rock for heat, also known as geothermal energy production. But very soon after I joined academia in 1977, we had a president at that time who was gung-ho on renewable energy, and he was followed by a president who was anti-gung-ho on renewable energy. So research and development in mining heat turned into research and development in mining more gas and more oil. So before the shale revolution began early in this century, I was working with the oil and gas industry to enhance their capabilities for hydraulically fracturing rock that was not shale in order to produce more oil and gas from increasingly stingy deposits around the world. So it wasn't until early this century that the industry unlocked finally the formula, the technological formula for getting oil and gas out of shale. So I had done some preliminary research in that area way back in the early 80s, courtesy of the United States Department of Energy and the U.S. taxpayer. But that was a different time then. We weren't very conscious at that point in the early 1980s about climate change or the environmental impacts, the negative environmental impacts that development of oil and gas from shale would really wreak.
You were in the right time and place. Maybe you could have become very, very wealthy with your fracking expertise. Why didn't you join the big race to frack everywhere?
I'm pausing to answer that question, Alex, because my wife asks me the same thing frequently. And I actually get accused by people who don't like the message I bring that I have enriched myself. I haven't. I don't take any remuneration for any of the public education I've done over the last decade or so in trying to inform the public and regulators and legislators and governors and even the president about the negative aspects of shale gas. Certainly, I've been invited by a number of oil and gas entities to rejoin the industry to help them improve the process of stimulating shale gas and stimulating oil out of shale. But I've chosen not to because I made a conscious decision 10 years ago that that was a very bad thing to do from a technological point of view, from a climate change point of view, and personally from a moral and ethical point of view.
Speaking of fracking everywhere, if a corporation wants to locate an industry with truckloads of toxic chemicals and lots of air pollution and noise, they are regulated usually into an industrial park or something. How is it possible in America to find fracking pads right next to schools or hospitals or even among homes in American suburbs?
I'm pausing again, Alex. I wish I knew, because I have spent a tremendous amount of time over the last 10 years involved in lawsuits brought by families who are suffering the consequences of exactly what you just described. They were quite comfortable living in a urban residential area or a rural residential area, typically in a zoned community, and they woke up one morning to find themselves in the middle of an industrial operation, a heavy industrial operation that is the only one, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, that is permitted to go beyond the normal bounds of zoning. That's that issue. What can zoning do? What can a local community do to enforce its own zoning regulations is at the heart of literally dozens of lawsuits that are occurring every day around the country in many states. And to directly answer your question, it's beyond me how we got there. The oil and gas industry is the only one, to my best knowledge, that has that exceptional power to overrule local zoning powers to keep an industrial, a heavy industrial activity, restricted to an industrial zone. It's literally allowed to go every place that you just described. It can be in my backyard, your backyard, within a few hundred feet of a school or a daycare center, within a few hundred feet of a hospital, within a few hundred feet of a food store. That's the way that things have developed in this country, largely because of the excuse of we need the energy and we have to get the energy. And today they used phrases like energy independence or more currently energy dominance or energy security. And the point is that fossil fuel source is one source of energy, but it's not the only source of energy, and it's not the only one that we could be tapping right now to meet all of our energy needs while at the same time making us energy secure and energy independent. So hidden in all the words I just gave you is the word politics, the word lobbying, the word influence. But I'm not qualified to talk about those things. I'm just an engineer, and I'm befuddled, absolutely confused about why it is that we can allow this heavy industrial energy to invade, literally invade our communities.
And your video presentation, though, does suggest five narrowly defined goals that sound like good reasons to introduce this technology. Can we talk about those and what they are?
Sure. These are the what I called in my video for the Bedrock series, the narrowly defined goals of the development of shale for oil and gas. The five narrowly defined goals are jobs, economic growth, energy security, energy independence, lower energy prices, and the displacement of dirty coal from our energy picture. Those are all very good objectives, very good goals. And to a large extent, in many locales around this country, we have succeeded to some degree in all five of those. But the point I'm making in my video is that complete success in all five of those areas is still a narrow victory, because it would only benefit about 5% of the world's population. And every one of those has an impact on 100% of the world's population. So it's easy for me to understand how an industry can convince regulators, legislators, from the local level all the way up to the federal level, that these narrowly defined goals are good things. It's obvious that they're good things. But the larger question is, for whom are they good? Well, they're certainly good for gas and oil companies and their shareholders. They're certainly good for some local businesses until the bust comes. They were certainly bad for coal. They were temporary in some cases, because obviously lower prices for some fossil fuels are going to go away as our fossil fuel resources deplete again, as they inevitably will. They are not renewable. And the concept of energy security, energy independence, as I just pointed out a few minutes ago, is ephemeral. The best way for the United States and every single country on the face of the earth to be both energy secure and energy independent is to produce all the energy it needs within its own borders. And the easy way to do that is with renewable energy. It's the easy way for the United States to become energy secure and energy independent.
You then go to the broader unintended consequences, and these are super important. They're huge. First, could you make your case that fracking caused the elongation of the fossil fuel era?
Yes. So the amount of oil and natural gas being produced in the United States was on the decline. Both oil and gas were on the decline, both from onshore and offshore sources, up until the discovery that it was possible to get oil and gas out of a heretofore unobtainable source, shale. The real revolution that we should be talking about is not fracking. Fracking isn't new. The real revolution was the application of a very specific form of fracking to a form of rock that had never been fracked before, and that's shale. So what was happening at the turn of the last century, in 1990s to 2000, is that we were rapidly depleting our own supplies of natural gas and oil. And other countries around the world were also depleting their supplies. And had we been wise at that point, and by then we recognized that climate change was upon us because of the use of fossil fuels, and had we been wise to see that we had wonderfully modern and cleaner means of supplying energy to all the countries on the face of the earth, renewables, we would have just ridden that decline all the way to its end. And my insight is that by this time, 2018, had we not turned to shale, we would be much farther along in the renewable energy transition that has now been delayed by 20 years. So the brief answer to your question is we were running out of everything. The United States had gotten to the point where it was only producing about a third of the oil that it needed, and we were importing natural gas, literally importing it because we could not meet demand. And what shale has allowed us to do is almost double the amount of oil we're producing and to increase by over 30% the amount of natural gas we're producing. And that's a definition of elongation, whereas we should have been in decline naturally because we were running out of stuff. We suddenly opened this door. We opened the cellar door, what I call the dark, dank basement of the fossil fuel resource on the face of the earth, the last remaining dark, dank corner, shale gas, shale oil. We figured out a way to get it out. We took that technological gamble, and here we sit 20 years farther into a fossil fuel era that should have been dead by now.
And you graphed out a timeline of the growth of shale gas fracking and the early exponential growth of wind power. Talk to us about that relationship and how much potential wind power was lost because of shale gas.
It's remarkably coincidental that I can show three graphs that all have what I refer to as kinks in them. And all those kinks occur in roughly the same period, 2005 to 2010. So let me remind your listeners that in 2005-2010 is when shale gas and shale oil really took off. So the three curves that have these remarkably coincident kinks are, number one, natural gas production in the United States. In that same era, 2005-2010, we were in decline. We were actually importing natural gas. And suddenly there's a kink, and we have a drastic increase in natural gas from shale. Is that a coincidence? Well, what's cause and what's effect here? The other coincidence is if we look at a graph of methane concentration in the atmosphere, we see that over the period roughly 1990 to 2002, 2003, the concentration of methane in the atmosphere was flat. It wasn't increasing, it wasn't decreasing, it was remaining the same. Suddenly and coincidentally, in that same period, 2005, 2010, we're seeing a drastic increase in methane concentration in the atmosphere, which is very important because methane is the second most important greenhouse gas after carbon dioxide. And the third coincidental kink in a curve is if I make a graph of the amount of wind energy that's available in the United States, starting at the beginning of this century and up until about 2007, 2008, we were on what a mathematician would call an exponential growth curve. The amount of wind energy being produced in the U.S. was roughly doubling every year. And then in that same period, 2005-2010, that exponential growth died out. It kinked. It became linear. In other words, it keeps increasing, but at a much slower rate. So we have these three coincidental kinks and three closely coupled curves. They're all interrelated. They all result from that technological gamble that the operators and legislators and governors and presidents decided to take roughly 15 years ago, and here we are. We have these coincidences, and none of them are good. The worst of them is that methane concentration in the atmosphere continues to rise, and that's exacerbating climate change.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest, Professor Emeritus Anthony R. Engrafia, was a pioneer in rock fracturing science at Cornell University. He says fracking gas is a gamble with the world's climate that we can't afford, no matter how cheap the gas appears to be. So, Tony, the final and worst unintended consequence, which you've touched on here and in your YouTube video, is about the worsening of climate change due to a new dependence on burning shale gas. And your first graph is from a paper led by Drew Schindel of NASA, published in the journal Science in 2011. Tony, what did their data show about the warming of the Earth since 1900? And then tell us about their projections.
What their paper showed, what the graph they're referring to that was in their paper showed that in the period 1900 to 2009, global warming had occurred to a degree of about 7/10 of 1 degree centigrade. So relative to the average temperature between 1890 and 1910, that was their zero, global warming had occurred at about 7/10 of a degree centigrade by 2009. And that was generally accepted by scientists around the world. They also, in their paper, decided to use computer simulation, the very, very best computer simulation that was available in 2010, 2011, to try to forecast, based on the history of global warming to that date, how global warming would occur over the next century. And, of course, they tried a number of different scenarios depending upon what the world was going to do with fossil fuel and greenhouse gases. And they realized that their computer simulations were, of course, just fortune-telling. They weren't truth. They were the very best scientific effort to try to predict what would happen. And so they were subject to error. And in their paper, they showed four different scenarios of what might happen between 2010 and 2070. And they also showed the error bars on their predictions. How far off do you think they could be high? How far off do you think they could be low on each of these four scenarios? And what they showed in their original paper is that regardless of which scenario you picked, we were going to get to 1.5 degrees centigrade by about 2050 or before, or in some cases way before, by 2020. And people were saying, well, geez, we have plenty of time. You know, the worst is 2 degrees centigrade, but their paper also showed that we would get to 2 degrees centigrade by as early as 2040, or perhaps not until later this century, depending upon which scenario. So I show that graph in my video, and then I show a new version of that graph, because the graph is old. It was published in 2011. And the data, the actual measurement of global warming, had been made 8 more times since that paper was first published. So what I did was to take the NASA-measured global temperatures for each of the 8 years after 2009, and I put those points on a new version of the graph. So in other words, I was adding data to the data that was in the original graph, which is what had happened between 1900 and 2009, went up 7/10 degrees centigrade. And to my disconsternation, when I plotted these additional 8 points, I found that we were already at 1.5 degrees centigrade in 2017. So the dreams and hopes of the Paris Accord that we would do our very best worldwide to try to avoid 1.5 degrees centigrade is a pipe dream. We're basically already there. And when I plot those new 8 points on this revised graph, I see that all of the simulations, all the predictions by simulation made by Schindel and his colleagues were wrong. They expected them to be wrong, but they were wrong in the worst possible way. Every one of them under-predicted the rate of global warming. The worst case scenario that they predicted in 2011 was that we would not get to 1.5 degrees centigrade until about 2040. But we're already there.
And you suggest that we might reach 2 degrees centigrade, which is sort of the let's go to catastrophe mark, as early as 2030. Are you confident in that?
I'm not confident. I'm scared to death, but I'm looking at the data and trying to visualize an extrapolation through these new 8 points, which of course don't all fall on the line. They do what all the temperature measurements made in history do. They go up, they go down, they go up, they go down. But in general, they're showing an increase. And if I just plot a straight line through those 8 points, we're at 2 degrees centigrade before 2040.
Okay, so in 2011, you and Robert Howarth of Cornell published two papers, and the most cited is published in Climatic Change, and it reports that frack gas, if I may summarize, results in far more greenhouse gases than either the government or industry were reporting, and I believe you said frack gas was more polluting than coal, is that correct?
From a climate change point of view, absolutely correct. It's because when you burn natural gas, you get carbon dioxide, just like you do when you burn coal. You get less carbon dioxide than you get by burning coal for the same amount of energy produced. But methane, natural gas, is also a greenhouse gas. And any methane, natural gas, that gets into the atmosphere unburned turns out to be about 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a global warming agent over a period of about 10 to 20 years. And I just got through telling you and your audience that we only have 10 to 20 years to worry about this problem and fix it. Let me rephrase. Over the next 10 to 20 years, every kilogram of methane that gets into the atmosphere unburned is 100 times more powerful, more potent as a greenhouse gas warming agent than carbon dioxide, meaning any small amount of methane is equivalent to a very large amount of carbon dioxide. And what we said in our 2011 paper was that we thought then, and we still think now, that a significant percentage of natural gas that's mined in the U.S. and in Canada and in Argentina from shale gets into the atmosphere unburned because of purposeful venting or accidental leakage. And we said that significant percentage is somewhere around 4, 5, 6, 7, 8%. And it doesn't matter whether it's 8% or 6% or 5%. If it's more than about 2 or 3%, it's deadly from a climate change point of view. It's worse than all the other fossil fuels.
But in the other article published in 2011 in the journal Nature, you and Robert Howarth argued that fracking should stop. But Terry Engelder from Penn State University said, and I quote, "The good news is that methane has a very short half-life in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide emitted during the building of the first Sumerian cities is still affecting our climate, whereas escaped methane from the fracturing of the Barnett Shale in 1997 is more than half gone." So isn't that a good news story? That's sort of the industry point of view.
Well, Terry Engelder is a good friend of mine, and we vehemently disagree. what he said is correct. But I said right before you said what he said is also correct. Methane only resides in the atmosphere for about 10 or 12 years, and then it becomes mostly carbon dioxide. But during those 10 or 12 years, it is a very potent warming agent. And I just got through telling you and your listeners that we only have 10 or 15 years to fix the problem. So during the 10 or 15 years that we have to fix the problem, all the methane that's being exhausted into the atmosphere today is warming.
Well, we won't have time in this interview to talk about fracked oil and its effect on the climate, and that just adds on to the whole problem.
Yes, it does.
It does. Okay. Now, in your video, you asked about, well, what do you think is happening in other countries? And I note that the French President Emmanuel Macron just visited the U.S. He dined with President Trump and then told a joint session of Congress that, yes, we should worry about climate change. If, according to the map in your published paper, France has a world-class reserve of natural gas waiting in its rock formations, what is happening with fracking there?
Absolutely nothing. It's forbidden.
Wow.
So France has taken the path of there shall be no shale gas development. But I already mentioned two countries that have followed the United States lead, in fact, the suggested lead of the United States way back in the Obama administration. Here is U.S. technology that we want to export. We're going to show you how to get oil and gas out of shale. And Canada is the second largest producer of oil and gas out of shale. And the third largest producer is now Argentina. And there are at least a handful of countries around the world that are exploring, experimenting with using this relatively newfound American technology, directional drilling, high-volume fracking, special chemical formulations, clustered multi-well pads. All that adds up into getting oil and gas out of shale. And so we've now exported. We've made the problem worse because not only are we doing it and adding our extra carbon dioxide and our extra methane into the atmosphere, we're encouraging other countries to do the same thing.
Would those countries include the UK or Australia?
The UK, there is now fracking permitted in England. It's not permitted in Scotland. It's not permitted in Ireland. Australia, some of the provinces of Australia have said no, they're in moratorium. Others have just decided that they're going to begin exploration.
And you end your recent YouTube presentation by asking what each of us can do to reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. Some folks in North Carolina are taking it to the streets. They're trying to fight off more fracking by their energy giant, Duke Energy. Isn't local resistance a big part of trying to stop the shale gas menace?
Yes, it is. And any kind of nonviolent resistance, activism, advocacy is exactly what we need. We need to depress the supply side of fossil fuels and also depress the demand side. That's what each individual can do. That's what I tried to emphasize in my video. So if you are taking an advocacy position or a peaceful activist position to try to get corporations and legislators and governors to slow down or even prohibit the development of shale gas and shale oil, you're depressing the supply side, and that's good. If you decide on the demand side that you're going to stop using a fossil fuel, for example, to drive your car or to heat your home or to heat your hot water or to cook the hot dogs in your kitchen or to light the light bulbs in your house, that's also a good thing to do. Both of those send messages to the market. We are a capitalist society. The transition that we're in right now from fossil fuel-based energy resources to non-fossil fuel-based energy resources is one that will be won in the marketplace. So who rules the marketplace? Consumers. So stop consuming or decrease your consumption of fossil fuels. Do what you can to inhibit the supply using peaceful means, even if it's a letter to the editor or carrying a banner in a protest march or putting a sign in your front lawn or voting for people who think the way you do about this energy transition. That's all good stuff. And at the same time, vote with your pocketbook and make sure that your next car is an electric car. Make sure that you really investigate whether you can heat your home and cool your home with an electric-driven heat pump where the electricity is coming from a renewable source. See what you can do about putting solar panels on your property or buying into a community solar farm. See what you can do to help the development of wind farms in your area rather than inhibiting them. These are all the kinds of things that individuals can and must do as participants in what has to be an energy transition, because if we don't have the energy transition, we're going to have the worst of climate change, and we don't have much time to do this. We've only got about a decade of years in which we can make significant change.
We have been talking with Dr. Anthony R. Engrafia, the emeritus holder of the Dwight C. Baum Professorship in Engineering at Cornell University. Ironically, this strong opponent of the modern fracking industry is one of the most published authors on how rocks fracture. And you can find links to his must-watch YouTube video that we've been talking about and all the papers we've discussed and more about shale gas fracking in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tony Engrafia, thank you for helping us understand the gamble we've taken.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.